KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Since my guest Adam Scott was here last, he had a very successful run on Parks and Recreation and has turned to producing himself with ACOD and The Overnight, which is just out this year. Had a big year working with Johnny Depp in Black Mass, and his new film as actor is, of course, what's the name of the film?
Krampus.
And it's just such a weird thing to say. First of all, welcome
making
back.
Making me say it.
Yes. What did you think when you got the script for Krampus?
Well, it's funny. They didn't let me read the script. They wanted me first to sit down with Michael Dougherty, the writer.
Had you seen Trick or Treat?
I had not seen Trick or Treat
Which is
yet.
A really great movie.
It's terrific. And I saw it the night. When I came home from the meeting with Michael, I watched Trick or Treat and rewatched Poltergeist. Because when I went and sat down with Michael, he wanted to chat and explain what he had in mind before I read the script. Just because, you know, it's called Krampus. You could make all kinds of judgments about something called Krampus that's like a horror movie kind of thing. And so we sat down and immediately hit it off because we were around the same age, grew up in the 80s and fell in love with movies in the era of the Amblin sort of, you know, PG-13. Well, now PG-13. Back then it was PG. The PG family suburbia in peril.
Films like Gremlins.
Gremlins and Poltergeist and E.T. even, I think. E.T. certainly set the tone for everything that came after it. And I know growing up in the 80s, I really loved those movies and kind of fell in love with that world and that suburbia that Spielberg really captured.
You like that weird kind of backlot suburbia?
Yeah.
There's nothing real about any of those movies.
There isn't, but I wanted that. I guess I was yearning for that to be, because I grew up in suburbia, but it wasn't like the suburbia I was watching in those movies. And I guess I thought, if my life could just be, if my suburbia could be as simple as that. Like, I remember Elliot's room from E.T. I remember every millimeter of that room and the sunlight coming through those shades and all his action figures, and I just wanted all of that. So anyway, that's what Michael wanted to make. He wanted to make an 80s Amblin movie, and I was so on board. I was just hoping the script was good, and they wrote a terrific script, so much so in that lane that I kind of jumped in immediately.
And it's interesting, too, just because one of my favorite parts of the movie actually connects back to, I guess, season's greetings. There's a really beautiful animated portion of the film. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I saw the movie the other night and was so surprised by that. I didn't know what they were going to do for that.
Oh, so you didn't know what that was going to look like. Did you see any previs or anything?
Nothing. I had no idea. And I just thought it was gorgeous. Really cool.
And just really kind of heartbreaking and sets the tone. And it's nice that it's almost an Easter egg in the movie. You have to really sit and wait for it. And I don't want to give too much away except to say the movie's really sweet and really fun. And the last time we were here, we were talking about The Vicious Kind, and you'd just given a serious performance in that.
Yeah.
And now you're doing this again here as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really struck by the sweetness of the movie as well. And yeah, I guess it is sort of a serious performance in a way. I mean, I think we really wanted, you know, the movie to be as grounded as possible and the stakes to be as real as possible with all these ridiculous things happening around us.
It's funny because it also in a weird way reminds me of Christmas Vacation. There's sort of a sense of yearning in it.
Yeah.
And wanting things, just wanting the past
yeah,
to live again. And I found myself thinking about that as I was watching it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think especially, you know, they have those photos up on the wall of the family kind of through the years of different Christmases. And we first took photo, Toni Collette and I stood there with babies taking these sort of Sears family photographs of a happy family all together on Christmas. And then I think there are five of them on the wall in the movie, and the final one, we're all disconnected and rolling our eyes. And so I think this is a family that's in a way sort of broken and sort of drifting apart from each other. And all of this crazy stuff that happens, you know, weirdly brings them back together.
But their photographs all through the movie. I mean, at one point you're looking for your lost daughter, you find a photograph of
that's
her
true, yeah.
and her boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, I really think the movie has so many really nice touches in it that kind of take that 80s Amblin thing and even goes a little further with it as well.
Yeah, but it's finally this movie about feeling. Mm-hmm. And this feeling that I think a lot of people may have during Christmas, so you'll find yourself looking back because you're so caught up in the awfulness of Christmas, like the opening credit sequence with the Black Friday shopping thing going on.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, as you get older, you kind of start reflecting a bit more than you used to and sort of watch this narrative. You look back and see this sort of narrative emerge of that's called your life, and it's easy to sort of get lost in that.
I guess I was thinking, too, a little bit about ACOD as I was watching, just because that's another movie about somebody looking back, basically wishing for a past that we don't know if it actually really happened or not.
Yeah, that's definitely – in that movie, that guy is definitely stuck in the past and definitely trying to control his present in order to make the future what he's determined it to be. He has decided that this is what his and his family's future will be, and then – things go a different direction, and he just is working as hard and running as fast as he can to try and get everything back on track to be the thing. Because he's always, I think, had like a pretty good handle on what his family is and what role everyone in his family plays, and he's sort of the puppeteer in a way, and then everything starts going insane, and the movie catches him at the point where he's trying to gather it all together again.
Well, I guess I was thinking too, but between The Overnight and ACOD and Krampus, they're all kind of these movies about people trying to control their narratives about the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to create these family, these family narratives for themselves.
Yeah.
Almost this thing you're talking about, wanting to have Elliot's room and wanting that suburbia you saw in those Amblin movies. But these are all guys doing that, kind of that same thing, aren't they?
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, even today, just this morning, what was I doing? I believe I was pouring cereal into a bowl and getting milk out of the fridge and pouring it into the bowl of cereal. And it's a thing I've been struggling with since I was a kid, when all I would do is watch movies and think about movies, where even menial tasks like getting yourself a bowl of cereal, I always wish I could just do it as cleanly and simply as it is in a sequence in a movie with someone making cereal. They cut it together. It's snappy. It looks cool. There's no spillage on the counter. It's all done. Then you're eating it. You're off to work, whatever it is. But I just can never get the thing open without slipping and then cereal flying on the floor. Whatever it is, my way of working my way through life is never as clean and tidy as it is in a movie or a TV show, and I'm still constantly disappointed by that.
It's a treatment. We're looking back with Adam Scott.
Oh my God.
Whose new film as actor is Krampus. But, I mean, even a little bit, and I think I emailed you about this, how much I like your performance, and I'm sorry to say this, Hot Tub Machine, too.
Yeah,
it's also another thing about somebody else trying to control a narrative in some way.
I guess it is, yeah.
I mean, it's just funny that these movies are all kind of connecting to this, I think this thing that you're talking about, that movies make us want to do. We learn how to dress in the movies, and we learn how to behave from movies.
Yeah.
And we think, you know, in this movie, this family is trying to make a movie Christmas. You know,
yeah.
It's very important that everything be in the order that it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I think this is a pretty tightly, when you meet us, we're a pretty tightly controlled family. I mean, Toni Collette's character and I are kind of living in different worlds, but we feel like we've pretty much got it all figured out and David Koechner and Alison Tolman's family come and sort of throw everything into chaos, and we feel like they're sort of lesser than us because they're, you know, this rural family and we're a little snobby. But then once everything kind of breaks loose, we find that we're all exactly the same, which is interesting.
But I guess I find this thing too. There's, if we look at sort of ACOD and the overnight, these are guys who are living through a lot of anxiety, and your character in Crap has kind of repressed all that. I mean, he almost seems to not even be connecting to anything except when he's talking about, well, you know, I guess that's what family is. You have to tolerate people you don't like.
Yeah. Not the best lesson to teach that's your son.
That was like, to me, like the real moment of heartbreak in a movie. Well, just sometimes they're just connected by DNA. You may not like them, but you have to tolerate them.
Kind of throwing in the flag, teaching his son to do the same.
I mean, was that one of the moments that you really liked playing? Because that's the point where he has his hands, he doesn't know what to do with himself physically.
I thought it was interesting that they had written that scene the way they did. You know, this being a studio horror movie, if you're just going to put a sort of a blanket statement on what the movie is and how it's going to be perceived, I thought it was an interesting scene. And I think there are a few scenes like that in the movie where there's just kind of little subversive moves here and there where the characters are sort of doing the best they can and they might not be making the best call emotionally that they could, but they're just sort of doing their best. And this is a moment, and I've had many of them as a parent myself, where you're just sort of improvising with what you've got and you try to provide a cushion of advice for your kids, but it may be wrong. You don't know. You're just kind of shooting from the hip.
I just think there's so many movies about the holidays that are kind of sad. I mean, actually, Gremlins is a Christmas movie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Which people tend to forget.
I know.
And I was thinking about how many movies, even Die Hard's a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
And there's so many of them are just about how people don't really know how to observe Christmas in the movies.
Did Gremlins come out in the summer?
It's
though?
A summer movie.
A summer movie. A
As was Die Hard, by the way.
That's so interesting.
It's a summer movie, but they were both about Christmas.
Well, so, you know, Shane Black's movies are all Christmas movies.
I've talked to him about that before. They're all Christmas movies about somebody in a downward spiral who has to reassess his life. The Long Kiss Goodnight is a Christmas movie. Even Iron Man 3 is a Christmas
movie. Yeah, it is. And
Lethal Weapon's a Christmas movie.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang's a Christmas movie.
They're all Christmas movies.
Yeah.
They're all about somebody who's basically at the end of his rope on Christmas Eve.
I wonder if Nice Guys is going to be a Christmas movie.
We're talking 80s movies with 80s movies and Christmas with Adam Scott. But I just feel like that's almost one of the things that maybe that we can relate to as audiences, the kind of melancholy that Christmas tends to often evoke in us. This because we're all trying to live up to this thing that you were talking about, what movies sell us or what media sell us, in fact. And so often we've been told what Christmas is supposed to be in those messages.
Yeah, you know, I remember seeing Bad Santa for the first time, and I went to see it on opening day. I was home in Santa Cruz and didn't have anything to do. It was like before I had a family or whatever. And so I was just kind of there, went to see it on a whim. I wasn't sure. I knew Terry Zweig, off director, so I thought this was going to be interesting. And I was so struck by that movie that I went to see it again the next day. I had to see this thing again. It was so funny, but it was also, I thought, such an honest movie and really heartbreaking. I found it to be very sad and thought that Billy Bob Thornton's performance was really deep, very felt performance. But the filmmaking was not apologizing for him at all, for his behavior at all. And it wasn't particularly glorifying it either, even though those laughs come from a place of, because we all wish we could say all those things he was saying about Christmas. And I think that is such an interesting movie, and I think the darkness that comes with Bad Santas is something we all, underneath it all, kind of feel about the holiday. And I think Krampus sort of picks up on some of that and really imbues it with this really hopeful, very sweet innocence that at least I wasn't expecting before I actually watched the movie.
We will take a break. We're talking Christmas sadness with Adam Scott. His new movie is actor is Krampus. It's the truth. It's more to come. Stay with us.
head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, more Christmas melancholy with my guest, Adam Scott, whose new film is Krampus. And, of course, we should mention Adam Scott being a personal friend of Bono, as we know from talking you two to me, the podcast. What was that like when those guys showed, when that happened, actually?
It was amazing. You know, Scott Aukerman and I have this podcast, You Talking You Two to Me, and we're just big fans of the band, but...
But like this show, the podcast is about everything.
Yeah, sure. It ended up being more of just a comedy podcast. And we have guests on and talk about YouTube, but also other stuff. And so their publicist reached out to us just to say, thank you. This is really cool. And so after a little bit of back and forth, we just emailed her and said, look, we should just have the guys. I mean, we can dance around this as long as we want, but how about having the guys on the show? What do you say? You know, and she was great. She said sure, and gave us a time and a place in New York in like 5 days from now when she sent the email, and we went there and met them at Electric Ladyland Studios, and all four guys walked in and sat down, and they sat with us for like an hour and a half. It was terrific.
And what I love about that particular episode, you can hear your excitement and fear.
No,
and...
in an embarrassing way. Like, I don't even – my interview style just consists of a series of compliments. I had never interviewed a person before, and so I think it very much shows. Scott really takes the – interviews for a living for a lot of the time, and so he's very skilled and very good, and I just kind of sat there like an idiot, but it was really fun and really really an experience that I don't think either of us will ever forget. It was very strange.
Because what I liked about that too, even on Scott's behalf, is I could hear his kind of excitement and anxiety.
Yeah, sure.
Too. I mean, it was completely there. And
yeah,
for a bit, I thought you guys were playing it. And so I realized after I could hear the quaver in your voices, mm-hmm. No, you're not joking.
Nope.
About being slightly unhinged by this.
And, you know, it would have been, if it was just The Edge and Bono, it would have been an incredible thing to have on our show, a credible honor and everything. But just the fact that it was the four guys, the history of that band and those guys was a little overwhelming. And also, we just never thought something – like, we didn't start this podcast thinking that we would eventually interview the band. It was kind of a – like, our fascination with this group and examining the minutia of this – of something that's so popular and mainstream, we thought would be a funny sort of meta thing, never thinking it would lead to actually sitting down with them. So the whole thing was absurd.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to interviewer Adam Scott,
yeah, right.
Whose new film is Krampus. Now, when you got the script and you saw that title on it, what did you, by that point, had Michael explain to you what the movie, what that was?
I vaguely knew what the creature was. Michael kind of explained Michael Dougherty, the director and co-writer. I just sort of thought there's some creature, but he explained the mythology behind it and everything. And it's interesting. It's where Santa Claus came from. Someone along the line thought we should get a Christmas mascot that doesn't make children want to cry.
And there's a whole thing in Europe, especially sort of Eastern Central Europe,
yeah,
about how terrifying a holiday Christmas can be.
Oh, yeah, because Krampus is going to come. If you haven't been good, he will kidnap you from your home and beat you with sticks. That's Krampus. So once he explained to me the mythology behind it, and he had all of this Krampus art up around his office, I thought it was really interesting. And for a studio movie, it could be this really neat sort of subversive.
Because actually, it feels that way, like Poltergeist, you kind of feel like this comes from a studio.
And it's right.
This kind of this sort of playfulness about horror, which horror movies, you know, the idea of scare comedies is still a pretty rare thing. There aren't that many of them.
It's hard to get that tone right. It's hard to really make it work. I think horror comedy is a really tricky thing. And I wouldn't even say this is a horror comedy. I guess it's more of just a family dramedy and then some kind of supernatural things end up happening, which is, you know, Poltergeist is a really funny movie. Going back and watching it again, I'd forgotten how funny it was. But the comedy comes from the true-to-life element, the fact that it really feels grounded and real.
Well, it's a real family. I mean, you get the sense, you know, they're like smoking weed after the kids are in bed. And you know, okay, yeah, this seems like a real family.
And Craig T. Nelson with the remote control battle with the neighbor and all that stuff. It's great. But, I mean, apparently it was secretly directed by someone very near and dear to all of our hearts.
Or at the very least, edited by that very same person.
Yes, indeed.
But that kind of playfulness in that movie, and that I think the 80s was a big period that you had that, and you had Ghostbusters, that period where where horror and comedy were combined. And the idea of making this a movie where you have to believe everybody in it.
I mean,
because so many school comedians in the movie. There's Conchita Farrell and David Koechner, like you said, and Toni Collette, people who could play it bigger if they had to. So I'm just wondering how you guys worked out that tone where every moment is being played as if it's actually happening rather than playing outside of it.
Yeah, I think in order to buy the danger of the moment, you can't always be, you know, rooting around for jokes. I think, you know, there are places in the movie where there are some laughs, hopefully. But there's also you have to choose those moments and try not to, because if everything is just a heightened joke, then the danger isn't going to be effective, and you're not going to care if these people live or die, and nothing's going to be scary. So I think we tried to make it, and Michael certainly was keeping his eye on making the comedy come from a very real place when necessary, but not wasn't the main objective to make it a hilarious movie.
But, I mean, I'm really so often aware of you as a vocal actor about the way you use your voice in scenes, and I was really impressed with the kind of quiet here. I mean, there's this restraint, and that just sort of changes into this concentration. I always wonder, and I mentioned it too about The Overnight, where that comes from for you in terms of figuring out how these guys sound.
That's interesting. I don't really, I'm not sure I really think about that too much before. You know, Overnight was such a different circumstance because we shot it in 10 days. We shot it for a very small amount of money, like a block away from our house. And the crew was 13 or 14 people, including actors. It was a small, small production. And my wife, Naomi, and I were producing it. And so it was a really nice freedom because I was so busy with everything else, with helping keep this train on the tracks, that the acting was, I would just jump in front of the camera at the last minute and just do it and didn't have time to overthink it. And I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed having my time completely filled around the acting, so I didn't have time to ruin it with my brain. And the couple of times I've had the opportunity to direct, it's the same thing. You feel like there's a lot of time on set when the camera is not rolling that as an actor you can drift off and watch your iPad or think about other things. If all of that time is filled for the entire day, you're much more tired at the end of the day, but it's a much more satisfying work day. So with Overnight, I'm not sure if I even thought about how this guy sounds. I was just trying to fulfill get the scene done so we could keep moving so we would have time to shoot the whole movie.
Wow, because I guess I thought just thinking about how all these guys sound, each of these characters sounds really different. And, you know, in ACOD, basically after his life starts to fall apart, you hear his anxiety every time. Oh, you can almost hear how constricted his breathing is after a while. Are you happy that so many of these last few movies have been about guys dealing with family? Because it feels like it's actually hitting pretty close to home for you.
Yeah, it is, actually. I guess so. I guess those are things that because I'm always thinking about my kids and are they happy enough? How can I make them more happy? Am I screwing them up? Am I spending enough time with them? Am I pressuring them to spend too much time with me? Am I a great father? Am I a terrible father? Why does that person seem like a much better father than me? All of that stuff it takes up a lot of my time, and so when that is reflected in the work, it's a I'm eager to kind of, you know, open that vein, I guess.
Well, you just think there's so few movies that really deal with family in any consequential way. I mean, you sort of know that the characters have family sometimes, but movies tend not to deal with it, or TV shows in any honest way. And I just was wondering if these movies, because these guys are all trying to sort of figure out their places in these families, if that becomes some kind of weather vane for you or in a way, because it feels like I can see the sort of maturation you as an actor in these roles.
Mm-hmm. I think also getting to the age I'm at and in the last couple of years started, I'd never been to therapy before and started going
What prompted that?
I felt like it was time. I felt like I should know why I'm who I am, you know? I had always talked to an imaginary therapist in my head. Like, this is probably what I'd be talking about if I was in therapy, and it would work out why I think I do this. Or then I just sort of thought, why don't I just go? And so I went, and it's extraordinary, as anyone knows who has found a good therapist. And so I've been reflecting a lot on my life, and so when these projects sort of veer into that lane a little bit, it's very raw and ripe for me right now, and I feel like I can add to it.
What was that disconnect like between having these therapy sessions in your head and then actually finally sitting down with a therapist?
Well, that's part of what I'm working out in therapy, honestly. I think it's good for anyone to sort of stop and think, you know, I'm worth the trouble to go sit down on that, in that chair or that couch or whatever, and talk to someone about why I think I am who I am and how I can be better, I guess.
It's interesting because you and me last year, I don't know if you remember, I talked about one of the things I liked about you is that I think of you being such a listener as an actor.
Yeah,
and well, you pay attention, and that's nice to watch. But I've also noticed in these past few movies, I don't know how much this relates to the therapy, but you're less apt to try to fill a space. Do you think that's a consequence of that too?
I think perhaps. I think maybe I was struggling for a very long time before I had any career to speak of. And when you are struggling career-wise, when you don't know if you're ever going to work again, and, you know, I still don't. I mean, that's all, you know, you never know. But when you are just sort of going from job to job, and your parts are tiny, you feel like you have to stuff as much as you can into limited space. But when you kind of relax and you don't grip the bat quite as tight and you are a little more confident with yourself and who you are and where you are in the world and what the material is and what it requires, you're not as anxious to fill the space.
Well, I mean, I really see it in this movie. Just that, I mean, there's a lot of quiet in this. Mm-hmm. And even just watching your stuff with David, and I can see there's a time you might have been a little more wound up and go back and forth. But there's just, it's not to say you weren't an actor before, but there's just a different way you're just encountering his character.
Oh, well, thank you. Appreciate that.
And the therapy's done. We're out of time. It's been too long. Please come back soon.
Please, anytime.
My guest is Adam Scott. His new film is Krampus. Please listen to Are You Talking YouTube to
Me? Oh, God.
I'm sorry. Listen,
I paid attention. At your own peril.
Okay, maybe it'll come back again. Our recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yor. The show is edited by Blake White, who's the associate producer. I'm still not going to therapy. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.